from WHYY in Philadelphia. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. The film The Right Stuff, based on the Tom Wolfe novel about America's early space program, is now out on a special edition DVD. On today's Fresh Air, Chuck Yeager tells us what it was like to be the first man to fly faster than the speed of sound. We'll hear from Alan Shepard, America's first man in space, and Chris Kraft tells us about being in the hot seat at Mission Control, where he was flight director for all the Mercury missions and many of the later missions. The Right Stuff, coming up on Fresh Air. The news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Carl Castle. Al Jazeera Television today aired what it said was an audio tape from Saddam Hussein. The voice on the tape said he was still in Iraq and it vowed more attacks on Americans. The voice said the tape was made on June 14th. The voice claimed credit for armed attacks on U.S. occupation forces in Iraq, and it called on Iraqis to assist the resistance groups fighting U.S. troops. There was no immediate way to confirm that the voice is actually that of Saddam Hussein, but those who know Saddam's voice say it sounded like him. U.S. troops have killed 11 Iraqis who ambushed a convoy on a highway north of Baghdad today. Just hours earlier, in the same area near Balad, at least 18 U.S. soldiers were wounded when mortar rounds slammed into a U.S. base. NPR's Kate Seeley reports that the area around Balad is a hotbed of Sunni Muslim activity.
Mortar rounds hit a base for logistical support forces near the town of Balad, which is northwest of Baghdad. Now, this town is in the Sunni Triangle. It's a hotbed of resistance to U.S. forces. It's believed that there are many Saddam Hussein loyalists in this town. Most significantly, the attacks have continued against U.S. forces in the Sunni Triangle, despite a crackdown by U.S. troops in that area. It was a crackdown launched last Sunday.
Reporting from Baghdad. Last night, a sniper shot and killed a U.S. soldier near the National Museum in Baghdad. Early today, attackers detonated an explosive on a highway in Baghdad's western outskirts, injuring two U.S. soldiers in a Humvee and three passengers in a civilian car. A curfew has been enforced in the southwestern Pakistani city Quetta. This after rioters took to the streets following an explosion at a packed Shiite mosque in the heart of the city. Some witnesses say the blast was the work of suicide bombers. Police say at least 10 people were killed. From Islamabad, Imtiaz Gul reports.
The attack on the Shiite mosque has triggered massive protests by the ethnic Hazara community. They denied police and rescue workers entry into the area by pelting stones at them. This also delayed the first aid to those seriously injured, most of whom were then evacuated into a nearby hospital by local residents and members of the community. Eyewitnesses said police had surrounded the tense neighborhood and were trying to get access to the mosque, but were being constantly frustrated by protesters. A small angry mob also escaped the police siege and set parts of the hospital on fire where the wounded were being treated. For NPR News, I'm Imtiaz Gul in Islamabad.
Liberian President Charles Taylor today said that he would step down, but only after an international peacekeeping force is deployed in his West African nation. Taylor added that the United States should send troops. President Bush is considering whether to send peacekeepers to Liberia. This is NPR News. Crews were again stepping up their efforts against a wildfire in southern Arizona. Winds have fanned the fire, which is proving difficult for firefighters to contain. Officials have revised the containment figure to 60%. From member station KJZZ, Mark Moran has more.
The Aspen fire was more than 70% contained before gusty winds blew the fire to the north yesterday, causing it to jump over lines cut to contain it. It's threatening an array of nearby telescopes and broadcast equipment. Residents have been evacuated from a small number of homes in the foothills north of Tucson as breezes push the fire in their direction. The blaze has consumed 56,000 acres of the Coronado National Forest, by far the largest fire in the Southwest this year, but still much smaller than the devastating 465,000-acre Rodeo Chedisky fire last summer. Officials warn that tinder-dry vegetation, thanks to an extended drought in the Southwest, will continue to be at extreme fire risk as the summer wears on. For NPR News, I'm Mark Moran in Phoenix.
Organizers of a drive to recall California Governor Gray Davis say they collected more than enough signatures to put the issue before voters. A total of nearly 900,000 signatures of registered voters is needed. Organizers say they now have more than 1 million signatures. Opponents of the drive say they're skeptical, and state officials have yet to validate them. The campaign expects to reach its goal of 1.2 million signatures by mid-July, which could result in a special election in the fall. Anti-recall forces have called the figure exaggerated. I'm Carol Castle, NPR News in Washington.
The NPR Shop introduces I Heard It on NPR, At Home in the World, a compilation of world music by artists featured on NPR programs at npr.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogaev in for Terry Gross. There's a new special edition DVD of the film The Right Stuff, based on the book by Tom Wolfe. Today we hear from three pioneers of the space program featured in the film, Alan Shepard, Chris Kraft, and Chuck Yeager. In his book, Wolfe calls General Chuck Yeager the most righteous of all the possessors of the right stuff. Yeager was a fighter pilot in World War II and was shot down in France, evaded capture, and returned to the air. After surviving many dogfights, he took another risky job, testing high-performance aircraft. He rapidly gained the reputation of America's top test pilot. And he was the first pilot to fly faster than the speed of sound on October 14, 1947. Here's a scene from the film The Right Stuff. Sam Shepard plays Chuck Yeager.
Say there, Yeager.
Sir?
We were just talking to Slick here about the sound barrier.
Is that right?
And we feel that the X-1 is ready to have a go at it.
We think the X-1's got the answer to go beyond Mach 1.
If there is any beyond. So what do you think, Yeager?
Well, I'll tell you what, half these engineers never been off the ground, you know. I mean, they're liable to tell you that the sound barrier is a brick wall in the sky. It'll rip your ears off if you try to go through it. If you ask me, I don't believe the damn thing even exists.
Waitress, a drink from Mr. Yeager here.
No, thanks, I got one.
So, do you think you want to have a go at it?
I might.
But, since, as you say, this sound barrier doesn't really exist, how much?
How much you got? I'm just joking. The Air Force is paying me already. Ain't that right, sir?
Well, sure, Yeager, but...
So when do we go?
Well, how about tomorrow morning?
I'll be there.
When Terry spoke with Chuck Yeager in 1988, she asked him whether he knew what the sound barrier was when he took on the assignment of trying to break it.
Sure, I knew the laws of nature, that sound travels at some 760 miles an hour at sea level and some 660 miles an hour at 35,000 feet and higher. I also knew we had buffeting problems because of shock waves, because I experienced those in air combat, you know, in World War II when I was flying Mustangs over Germany. I also experienced it in the early jets, the P-80s and P-84s. I knew exactly what the problem was.
So what image did you have in your mind about breaking the sound barrier? For civilians like us, you almost see this invisible shield or a wall that somebody will be penetrating as they break it.
Yeah, I didn't, give any thought to you, to tell you the truth, Terry, because I was pretty well duty-oriented at that time. I'd been in a war where, a lot of guys get killed, but I'd learned to discipline myself to concentrate on what you're doing and forget about the outcome, because you can't do an awful lot about it anyway. So when we started the X-1 program, I had no idea what I would run into, but the point is, I could care less, to tell you the truth. That I just had to press on with my mission. So
the plane that you broke the sound barrier in, the X-1, had a nose cone that was designed like a bullet. How come?
Yeah, because they knew that bullets flew faster than sound, and the ogive, or shape of the fuselage of the X-1, was shaped like a 50-caliber bullet, and that's just common sense, because, like I say, we're flying in the area of unknowns.
Was it comfortable where you'd have to sit in the...
Well, no, it was very uncomfortable, and the reason was we had no source of power in the X-1. We used compressed nitrogen gas to do all the work, like raise and lower the gear and pressurize the liquid oxygen tanks, which, incidentally, they had no seat in the X-1. You sat with your back against the bulkhead, which contained the liquid oxygen, and the temperature of the liquid oxygen was 290 degrees below zero, and it was one of the coldest cockpits I've ever been in my life. And you sat on the floor, and your knees were higher than your rear end, so you could pull high G's without blacking out, and you couldn't see too well out of it. But you got to remember, it was a research airplane, and it was built in 1944. So.
Well, when you were flying it, what indications would you have? What kind of meters would tell you when you had actually broken the sound barrier?
Well, I had an altimeter that told me how high I was. I had an indicated airspeed and that told me how fast I was going through the air in miles per hour. But the one thing that we relied on was a Mach meter that told us what our percentage was in relationship to the speed of sound. For instance, Mach 1 is the speed of sound at the altitude you're flying. And if you're going 0.9 Mach, that's 90% of the speed of sound. Because, see, an airplane responds to the effects of the speed of sound, like or shock waves on the airplane, so you're only interested in your percentage of the speed of sound or the Mach number that you're going. I had a Mach meter that went up to 1.0, and the day that I actually broke Mach 1, I sat there and watched that Mach meter build up, you know, since we'd been up to about 0.94 or 0.95 Mach number on the previous flight, and I watched it build up, and when it got up to about 0.96, and then that buffeting was quite heavy on the airplane. It was shaking pretty bad. But then at that point, the Mach meter went off the scale. And if I extrapolated, you know, it'd be about 1.06, but the Mach meter only went to 1.0. But when it did, all the buffeting smoothed out, which was an indication that we had, you know, supersonic flow over the whole airplane, meaning that it was flying at supersonic speeds. And when this happened, we made the first sonic boom there at Edwards, and that's about the way it happened.
Could you hear the sonic boom from the plane?
No, you're in the airplane, which is in a pressurized cockpit, and you've got a helmet on, an oxygen mask, and no, you're making the shockwave. It's on your airplane, and you don't hear a shockwave or sonic boom.
When you realize that you'd broken the speed of sound, that your mission was accomplished, did you stay up in the air a while and just have a good time and celebrate?
I didn't have... No, you can't stay up because, see, a rocket, you burn out all of your fuel. It only had to last 2.5 minutes, and then you're gliding down to make a dead stick landing on Rogers Dry Lake out there at Edwards or then Muroc Air Base. But I was elated. I did a couple of rolls, and when I got down, since I was pretty well beat up from a horseback riding accident a couple of days before, I was kind of bushed. And also, you're sitting in that cold airplane. You really get cold soaked, and it's good to get out into the warm sun. And, you know, and also their program was classified, so it's not exactly as the film The Right Stuff depicts it. But we knew it was classified, and just a couple, three of us had a little party that night. I mean, big party, if you want to call it that.
What were the reasons for classifying it? Why was it so top secret?
Because of what we found out. And the reason was, if you recall, once we got into the region of the speed of sound, we lost our elevator effectiveness. Now, Terry, this may get a little technical, but all airplanes, light airplanes, if you looked at them, they have a horizontal stabilizer or a tail, and on the trailing edge of that horizontal stabilizer and the elevators are flippers. And when you move the control stick back, that elevator goes up, and that's what controls the attitude of your airplane. It makes the nose go up or go down. And when we got into up to about 0.93 Mach number, or 93% of the speed of sound, we lost the effectiveness of that elevator on the X-1, and we couldn't control our airplane. But we had built a capability into the X-1 of moving the whole horizontal stabilizer or tailplane, and we found out that, lo and behold, we could control the X-1 through Mach 1 with that horizontal stabilizer. Now, it was interesting to me, when that happened, we found that out. Then, of course, we started building flying tails on our airplanes, that our combat airplanes that were built 3 or 4 years later. And it was amusing to me to find out that the British and the French and the Soviet Union didn't find out that little trick for 5 years. That was the reason it was classified, and mm-hmm. rightly so.
How else did breaking the sound barrier change aviation?
Well, it opened up space to us. Up until that time, you recall, we would never had had an airplane out beyond the speed of sound, and we didn't know what problems we would run into, and that flying tail that I mentioned is one of the secrets we found out that solved a lot of problems. We also developed higher thrust engines that could drive fighter aircraft or operational aircraft through the speed of sound. Once we got beyond the speed of sound, then there's no other barriers other than heat, and that opened up space for us.
Now, this is a very exciting time when you were flying these test missions. You had a few close calls, though, when you were flying the X-1 and the X-1A. There was one time, I think it was in the X-1A, which was the follow-up plane to the X-1, where you had gotten too high.
Well,
and,
too fast, Terry. See, in those days, back in the late 40s, early 50s, we were a lot of milestones to be broken. And we were moving out in speed. We'd broken Mach 1 in 1947, and 1953 rolled up, and we were working up above Mach 2, and we were just trying to go faster and faster to open up the universe. And the X-1A, I only made four flights in it, but on that particular flight, I'm setting at some, 80,000 feet, going 2.5 Mach number, or 2.5 times the speed of sound, or around 1,600 miles an hour. And we found out during that flight that the tail was not big enough on the X-1 to stabilize it, like the vertical stabilizer and the horizontal stabilizer didn't keep the airplane going straight ahead when we got out beyond 2.3 Mach number, and the airplane just swapped ends and went through some wild gyrations. And back in those days, we didn't have ejection seats, and you were pretty well locked into the airplane and couldn't get out, so you have to ride it down. And I was a little apprehensive about where I was going to hit in the high Sierras out there, but fortunately, I stayed with the airplane and had enough instinct to recover from an inverted spin and then pop it out of the normal spin and find Roger's Dry Lake and come back and land. And I tell you, it was a wild ride, but the way I look at it, you either do or you don't. And, if you don't, you live happily ever after. So.
Well, you describe what it's like to see the ground coming up at you at 1,000 feet per second. That's a pretty dramatic image. How do you react? I mean, how can you think clearly under those circumstances when you're just like seconds away from meeting the Earth?
That's, you don't think, as I mentioned here a few minutes back in the broadcast, you really don't think about the outcome of anything. You concentrate on survival at the time, and you do everything you can to save your tail. And that's what I was doing, trying to fight the airplane to recover it from the spins. And my pressure suit was inflated. I was pretty well beat up because of high G loads and rattling around in the airplane. And no, I didn't pay any attention to the ground because, it's nothing to do about hitting it anyway.
Now, you say that some pilots end up crashing because they take too long to decide whether to jump or land when the plane has gotten out of control.
Well, accidents in aircraft, there's human error involved in accidents about 75% of the time. Now, this could be pilot error or maintenance error or design or something. It was, anyway, the human element enters into it. And in the early days when we started flying jet aircraft and we put ejection seats in them, then when a pilot gets himself, he always tries to save an airplane. And that was one of the transitions. When we first put ejection seats in our fighters, that gave us the capability of saving the pilot, but you lost the airplane. Now, one thing that a pilot hates to do is to leave an airplane because he tries to save it. And the way you save a crippled airplane is by dead sticking it or a flame out landing, meaning try to get the airplane on a road or an airplane when you haven't got any power. In order to do this, you have to be very good, number one, and number two, you've got to have a very good surface to land it on. And most pilots will try to get the airplane down on a runway, but since they don't have any power, they may screw up their pattern or miscalculate on their pattern. Then at the last minute see, well, I can't possibly get this airplane down safely. I'll eject. But by then they're too low for their egress equipment to work, or the parachute or the ejection seat. So you lose your pilot and your airplane. So we went through a period of time back in the 50s when we had to really discipline pilots. If you lose your engine on this airplane, you eject, period. And don't fool around with trying to get it down in a dead stick landing.
How many times did you have to eject?
I bailed out of three airplanes. I lost, had a P-39 and while in training back in 43, a blow up on me. And I also got shot down in a Mustang, and I bailed out of that one. And then I ejected out of the NF-104, which had a rocket seat in it, and I had a pressure suit on, and that was in, 63.
Now, you started off your flying career in the military you started as a truck mechanic, and mechanics is what led you into the military in the first place. How did you get from a mechanic to a flyer?
Well, like You're right. My dad trained me as a mechanic, and I worked on all of his machinery. And then when I enlisted in the Air Force in 1941, straight out of high school, and America was mobilizing, so that was the thing that guys did. I was working on aircraft, and I was a crew chief. And those pilots had a little more fun than us maintenance types did. And lo and behold, in the 1st of December 1941, before the war started, or before we got in the war, there was a bulletin on the bulletin board. I noticed a paper up there said, hey, if you're 18 years of age and have a high school education, you can apply for pilot training. You won't be commissioned a second lieutenant, because you'll be made a sergeant pilot. And I looked at that, and I said, hey, I'm 18. I have a high school education. So I applied for it, took my physical, and they called me up in the summer of 42, and I started flying, and then I started enjoying it. And, you know, it's just right place to right time, Terry.
You trained a lot of men who became astronauts. Do you regret that you missed the period where you could have become an astronaut yourself and gone off into space?
Well, I didn't miss the period. Actually, I was prime for the space program, which started in 1959. The only problem was, in order to apply for the space program or the first Mercury astronauts, you had to have a degree. And I didn't. I had a high school education, so I wasn't qualified and I didn't apply. Had I been qualified, I probably would have applied. But I didn't, because I wasn't. But I was perfectly happy with doing the research flying that I'd been doing in the X-1, the X-1A, and the other aircraft there at Edward. Yeah, it'd be fun to fly an airplane like the shuttle. I wouldn't particularly care about riding in a capsule like the Mercury, Gemini, or the Apollo capsule back in the old days. But the shuttle, that's a different story. It'd be fun to fly. But on the other hand, it'd be a waste of money to train me.
Why?
Well, I'm too old. You wouldn't get a lot of longevity out of me, see?
Chuck Yeager speaking with Terry Gross in 1988. Coming up, America's first man in space, Alan Shepard. This is Fresh Air. A new special DVD version of the film The Right Stuff is just out, and we're featuring interviews with some of the early heroes of the space program. Alan Shepard was the first American in space. In 1961, he rode the space capsule Mercury 7 to an altitude of 115 miles. 10 years later, Shepard commanded the Apollo 14 on a mission to the moon. In between those two space flights, Shepard was grounded for medical reasons, but he helped direct the space program as chief of NASA's astronaut office. He was an essential part of the team that helped America first get to the moon 25 years ago. One of Shepard's most embarrassing moments was immortalized in the film The Right Stuff. In this scene, Shepard is played by Scott Glenn.
Gordo, I have to urinate.
Urinate? No.
Oh, boy.
Urinate? No, we did not think of that. This is only a 15-minute flight.
Yeah, well, the man's been up there for hours.
Could he just do it in his suit?
It might be dangerous to introduce liquid into the pure oxygen environment of the capsule and the pressure suit. It might cause a short circuit. It could start a fire. No, tell him he cannot.
Say, listen, old buddy. They promise we'll stop at the next gas station.
Request that you remain in a holding pattern till then.
In case you're wondering, Shepard eventually got permission to go in his suit. When Terry spoke with Alan Shepard in 1994, she asked him about his first space flight back in 1961. The trip was brief, so he didn't have much time to experiment with weightlessness.
My flight was only 16 minutes. We did have about 5.5 minutes of weightlessness. And the thing which we tried to cram into that 5.5 minutes had to do primarily with my ability to actually control the spacecraft, actually fly it like an airplane. Because we knew that so much of the early days of space depended upon the abilities of a pilot, not only under primary conditions with no casualties, no failures, but also to practice for situations where the pilot would have to take over in order to bring it back in safely. So most of the 5.5 minutes were devoted to my actually controlling the spacecraft and reporting how I was doing and that sort of thing.
How were you doing?
I did great, of course. I would.
I mean, how did it feel to control the spacecraft while being weightless?
Well, it was a tremendous exhilaration, of course, at being up there in the first place. Also, the second place, the fact that everything was going well. And then, lastly, the fact that I flew it exactly as I was supposed to fly it.
Was it what you most wanted, to be that first American in space?
Oh, I think all of us wanted that. We were a very highly competitive group to start with. We were all test pilots. We knew that only one of the seven was going to get to go first. And, you know, everybody wanted to go.
Now, after you became the first American in space, you got something called Meniere's syndrome. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yes, that's correct. Actually, I had been assigned to command the first Gemini mission, which was the first two-man mission. Tom Stafford was going to be my co-pilot. We were probably 3 or 4 months into a training cycle when I developed Meniere syndrome, which has something to do with elevated fluid pressure in the inner ear, which causes dizziness, imbalance, nausea in some cases. And when we discovered it was more than just a temporary virus, then NASA, of course, grounded me immediately and said, you can stick around if you want. There is maybe 20% chance that you might recover from this thing normally. And if you want to stick around and stay in training, we'll be happy to have you do that. We'll give you a job helping Slayton run the astronaut training program.
It must have been devastating for you.
Very disappointing. Not only the initial reaction to it, to the onset of it, the realization that I wasn't going to fly again right away, and then continuing to watch the rest of the guys go down to the Cape and have all these great flights and pat them on the head before they went, and, you know, and pat them on the fanny when they came back. It wasn't all that much fun. There was a lot of frustration involved.
You were the chief of the astronaut office, which meant that you, among other things, had to choose which men went on the flights. What would you look for in an astronaut's personality and temperament before deciding to schedule them for a flight?
Well, what we did for the most part was to choose the ones who, the individuals who we thought would make the best commander of the flight, and then ask them which of the available astronauts they would like to fly with. So we got an idea that we got two folks, or three folks in the case of Apollo, at least friendly with each other. We made a couple of mistakes, but for the most part, things went along pretty well.
Alan Shepard from a 1994 interview with Terry Gross. We'll hear more of their conversation later on in the second half of the show. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more of the right stuff. We'll hear from Chris Kraft, flight director of the Mercury missions. Also, Alan Shepard will be back to tell us about the first time he viewed the Earth from the moon. The film The Right Stuff has just been released on a special edition DVD.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. The film The Right Stuff about the early space program has just come out in a special edition DVD. One person featured in the movie never traveled into space. Instead, he was the man in headphones at Mission Control. Chris Kraft, otherwise known as Flight, was the last stop in the chain of command. Kraft was a member of the original Space Task Group in charge of NASA's first major program, the Mercury missions. He directed the first rocket launches, created Mission Control in Cape Canaveral, and was the flight director for all the Mercury missions, some of the Gemini missions, and director of flight operations through most of the Apollo program. One of the things that Kraft designed was the tradition of the countdown. When I spoke with him in 2001, I asked him to describe the seconds leading up to Alan Shepard's first flight.
This was the first time that we had a man on the end of a rocket. Nobody had ever done that before. You never got serious about any countdown until you got to T-minus 2 minutes. That's when you knew, when you went past that point, you damn well better get ready to launch. Now, at that time, Shepard's heart rate was about 220. I don't know what mine was, but later flights said mine was about 180. If you don't realize that this is dangerous, that something bad can happen a lot of the time, and that this is the first time that a man is going to be the end of a damn rocket, and you're not shaken, you damn well don't understand the problem.
Now, in the second manned flight, Gus Grissom was the astronaut, and everything went off pretty much fine except for the splash landing. Somehow the hatch blew off prematurely. The capsule sank, and Grissom had a tough time of it staying afloat. NASA never really did find out what exactly happened, and there have been two camps. Some thought Grissom panicked and hit the hatch detonator, and others thought that it was some unknown malfunction. After all the investigations into this, what did you think went wrong?
I believe Gus. When Gus said, "I didn't hit the button, that damn thing blew off by itself, and the first thing I saw was water coming over the sill," I said, "That is 100% correct."
You thought that then, and you think this now?
I thought that then, and I think it 10 years, 20 years, and I will always think that. Gus was a superb test pilot, maybe one of the best, if not the best. And there was no question in my mind he told us what happened. I think a lot of people couldn't figure out how in the world that could happen. Because in all the tests we ran after that, we couldn't make it happen. We shook the thing, we hit on it, we did everything we could, and we couldn't make it go off inadvertently. But Gus said it went that way, and I believed him. I still believe him.
I'd like to back up a little bit back to 1962, to John Glenn's first flight. There was a problem with his flight. There was a question whether the heat shield was loose or not. And if it was loose, the capsule would ignite on reentry. Could you describe the scene in Mission Control and what your options were for that flight?
Yes. When the spacecraft flew over the Cape on the second time, there was a telemetry signal, radio signal coming down from the spacecraft that said the spacecraft heat shield was loose. And that came from a measurement of a small switch, which moved when the heat shield actually loosened up and then dropped free down about 3 or 4 feet. And there was a bag there, which acted as a impact alleviation device when it hit the water. I heard that problem as it was presented to me. He said, "We see this signal." And I said, "Well, we haven't had any noises. Glenn hasn't reported anything from the spacecraft. He hadn't heard any noises of the heat shield being loose. We haven't had any problems controlling the spacecraft in terms of anything bouncing around.
It's got to be a false signal.
So you had a gut sense that this
I was absolutely convinced in my mind that it was a false signal. And that's not unusual in a instrumented system. Many times the thing you're trying to use to measure it fails. Not unusual in any, as an engineer, common occurrence. So I thought to myself, and I confirmed that by talking to my other engineers, and I talked to Alan Shepard about it, as a matter of fact. And we all concluded that's erroneous. Now, in comes the chief designer, and in comes my boss, and he's listening to the two chief designers, one from McDonnell, one from NASA. And they're saying, well, we think it probably is wrong also, but what if it isn't? And so I listened to those arguments, and they said, well, if we keep the RetroPack on, the straps that hold the RetroPack will maybe hold the heat shield up tight against the spacecraft, at least until it gets into the sensible atmosphere, and then the atmosphere will keep it there. That might be a better chance and a better thing to do in case, in the 0.1% case, that it might be right. So I listened to those arguments, and I said, I don't think so. Then my boss said to me, but I think that it's still a good thing to do, so do it. I didn't like that direction, but he was my boss at the time, and we left it on. That was a damn bad thing to do. Because the reason I didn't want to do it is because you could have gotten a Mach cone coming off of that heat that RetroPack that was still there and burn a hole in the heat shield. And that was what worried the hell out of me, because we'd had something like that happen before. So after that was all over, I'll tell you what I said. I know a hell of a lot more about this thing than they know. I've got a lot better engineers telling me what's going on than they have. And the next time they tell me to do something, they better think twice about it, because I ain't going to do it unless I'm convinced it's the right thing to do.
Chris Kraft, from an interview recorded in 2001. More of our conversation after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back now to our interview with NASA's first flight director, Chris Kraft. Now, a month before the first Apollo mission, during a checkout flight, a fire broke out in the spacecraft at Cape Canaveral that was manned by Gus Grissom, Ed White, and Roger Chaffee. You were in mission control in Houston.
Yes.
What was your experience in Houston during that crisis?
Well, I was sick in the stomach. I was about as stunned as I've ever been in my life before or since. It took 2 or 3 minutes to realize that you just killed 3 men.
When did you first know something had gone wrong? What did you hear in your headphones, or what alerted you?
I heard some screaming. I heard some confused people on the launch pad out external to the spacecraft. I heard a voice with which I was very familiar say, "We're on fire." And I heard another voice which I was very familiar with saying, "Get me out of here." And then I heard silence. And then I heard people scurrying about. And I was afraid to ask. And when I did ask, I got the answer I knew I was going to get and didn't ever want to hear.
Was there anything that could have been done to get the astronauts out?
In that spacecraft, it took, at a minimum, 2-3 minutes for an astronaut to turn around in his seat, crank a crank, which opened the hatch, and by that time, under these circumstances, where they were probably dead within a few seconds, there was nothing anybody could do.
How did the fire start?
Started by we never really knew exactly what happened because most of the wiring in the area where the fire did start, which was below Gus Grissom's couch on the left side, was burned up. But almost certainly there was a bare wire there, and almost certainly there was a spark, and that's all it took.
Now, you write that that fire was the reason that future Apollo missions were a success, that you owe it to that tragedy. How so?
I think that the whole team of government and industry were running as fast as they could to get to the moon. And so they were running so fast, and they thought that that goal was so important that they did things which were less than the best. And under their judgment, that was acceptable. After the fire, it was totally unacceptable. And as a result, the pause that we had to take to prove what happened, to understand what happened, to fix that environment so it wasn't there anymore, and to make modifications to the spacecraft in many, many critical areas. We were able to do that in the hiatus that took place after that. And without those modifications, we would have been a long time getting there, because I think we would have experienced a heck of a lot more failures and probably kill more people in space as a result.
You write that you envied the astronauts, that after so many years planning to get a man on the moon, did you wish you weren't staying behind on the ground?
Be perfectly honest, No. I never wanted to go.
Why not?
Because I was on every flight. Vicariously, I was on every flight. They only got to fly once. I got to fly every time they went.
Do you think you could do it? Sit there 43 stories up on top of all that explosive material?
Not without being anesthetized.
Knowing what you know.
You got that right. I mean, if you don't think that lighting up millions of pounds of thrust, burning millions of pounds of propellant every few seconds is dangerous, you don't understand the problem. And that's true today when they fly the space shuttle, like it was when we flew Alan Shepard on the Redstone rocket.
Chris Kraft, recorded in 2001. Kraft has a memoir called Flight, My Life in Mission Control. Let's continue Terry Gross's conversation with Alan Shepard. When we left off, he was grounded for an inner ear problem, but surgery cured it, and he was given the go-ahead to return to space. In 1971, he went to the moon aboard Apollo 14.
How old were you for this flight?
Well, actually, when I was walking around the moon, I was 47 years old.
That's pretty old for an astronaut. That's pretty old for a flight to the moon, isn't it?
Well, I think age is a very much of an individual thing. I still feel very young at my current age, which is, you know.
Now, before you landed on the moon, you lost your radar, and Mission Control was thinking you should abort, but you didn't. Why didn't you want to abort?
You got to be kidding. I mean, after going 230,000 miles, you're going to worry about a little radar? Come on.
A little radar? I mean, what was it like for you to maneuver the ship without radar? What was blinded without radar?
Well, actually, let me just back up a little bit. We had a problem earlier on the way out where we couldn't dock with a lunar module. That was traumatic. We finally got that resolved, and off we went with permission to land. We started down. Well, we didn't actually start down, but we ran the computer down open loop, and it refused to go down because it was a bad switch. And so that was point number two. Either one of those would have ruined the mission. So we were pretty objectively oriented when we came to the point where, during the descent, one is not looking at the moon. You're looking away from the surface. And in order to be allowed to continue below around 13,000 feet or so, one has to have an update from landing radar. We were down around 20,000, somewhere along in there, and we were not getting updated on the radar. And we were being told from the ground that the radar wasn't working. We said, thank you very much. We understand the radar is not working. We can tell that. And they reminded us that we didn't have landing radar in by 13,000 feet. We said, yeah, we remember all that stuff. And it was getting pretty tense and pretty close. Finally, some bright young guy in the control center said, hey, this landing radar is working, but it's locked on infinity. Have them recycle, pull a circuit breaker and see what happens. So we pulled the circuit breaker, and sure enough, the landing radar came in with a matter of, maybe a half a minute or so to spare. We go on down and land, and we're shutting off the switches. And my co-pilot, Ed Mitchell, said to me, Alan, what were you going to do if the landing radar was not in at 13,000 feet? And I said, Ed, you will never know.
Well, what did you plan on doing?
I think I would have gone down, at least to the point where we could have pitched over and taken a look at the surface, because I had great, great faith in our ability to land from almost any off-nominal case. We practiced that in the simulator for hours and hours and hours, and so I had a feeling that if I could just see it and realize I wasn't running into any mountains or anything, that I probably would have gone down.
What surprised you most about how the surface of the moon looked?
I don't think we had any surprises about the actual surface of the moon, about the barrenness. We had looked at pictures of our landing site taken by previous missions. We had worked with the models that were made from those pictures. We knew the general configuration of where the craters were supposed to be. We knew the objective of Cone Crater, which was the one we climbed up the side of to get rock samples. There weren't any surprises there. The surprise I had was standing on the surface after we'd been there for a few minutes, having a chance to rest a little bit and looking up at the Earth for the first time. Now, you have to look up because that's where it is. And the sky is totally black, and here you have a planet which is four times the size of the moon as we look at it from the Earth. And you also have a color. You have a blue oceans and the brown land masses, the brown continents, and you can see ice on the ice caps on the North Pole and so on. And just an absolute incredible view. And then you say, that looks a little small to me. It looks like it does have limits. It's a little fragile. You know, down here we think it's infinite. We don't worry about resources. Up there you're saying, gosh, you know, it's a shame those folks down there can't get along together and think about trying to conserve, to save what limited resources they have. And it was just very, very emotional. I actually shed a couple of tears looking up at the Earth and having those feelings.
Alan Shepard talking with Terry Gross. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you.
Back now to Terry's 1994 interview with Alan Shepard.
What was the best advice that you got from astronauts who'd been to the moon before?
Probably, hey, it ain't so tough after all, fellas. Just go up there and relax and have fun.
One of the things you did on the moon was to hit a couple of golf balls. Where did the golf club come from and the golf balls? And why'd you do it?
Well, I enjoyed the game of golf before I went, and I tried to think of something that would demonstrate the fact we only had 1/6 gravity, which means the ball is going to go 6 times as far for the same club head speed. There's no atmosphere, so the ball is not going to hook or slice, and the time of flight is going to be 6 times as long. So I started thinking about it and very quickly realized that we had a collapsible handle there, aluminum handle, we used with a scoop on the end, and we used that to scoop up samples of dust, and we put them in a little bag and mark the bag and bring it back. We use that because it's very difficult to bend over and get a sample from a virgin dust. But that would have been left up there, so I took a look at it, and it was about the same as the length of a shaft of a number 6 iron. So I got the head of a number 6 and cut it off and put a little fitting, had a pro put a little fitting on it to snap on the end of this club. And I had the club head and the 2 golf balls in the pocket of my suit. I had practiced before we went. I got the boss's permission to do it. And at the very end of the mission, when all was completed, I snapped the club head on the handle, tossed the 2 golf balls down in the dust, kind of teed him up a little bit, and took a whack and did it in front of the television camera. So we have a great picture in the book of this ball sailing up and off into the black sky. The suit was kind of cumbersome, and I couldn't swing as hard as I wanted, so it probably would have gone maybe 30, 35 yards with one hand shot here on the earth, but it went over 200 yards. The time of flight was like 40 seconds. Just an absolute thrill for me to do that. And in the book, you actually see a picture of the golf ball still in the frame, which is kind of cute.
And one of the things that really amazes me about your life is that, okay, you're the first man in space, American in space, and then you walk on the moon. But when you were young, you went to school in a one-room schoolhouse. It seems like such an enormous gap between a one-room schoolhouse and a walk on the moon.
Well, that's true, but I sense that there is something here that was helpful to me. I remember, of course, that being in a one-room school with one teacher, there was a tremendous amount of learning time there. Very, very strict teacher, as I recall. She was about 8 feet tall, and she had a long yardstick that she used to whack our knuckles with. But there was a sense of discipline instilled at that time, which I responded favorably to. And I think that sense of discipline obviously served me in good stead going through the Naval Academy, served me in good stead as a pilot, as a test pilot, as an astronaut. So maybe, maybe that one-room school thing wasn't so bad after all.
Were there airports around you when you were growing up?
There was one fairly close by. In high school, I used to work at that airport on weekends. I'd ride my bike up and push airplanes in and out of the hangars and get a free ride once in a while.
Did you love it?
Oh, yeah. I've always wanted to fly. Built model airplanes. Lindbergh was my hero when he flew across the Atlantic. And very, very fortunately, we're talking about Apollo 11. When the Apollo 11 launched, I was at the Cape, standing by myself over in the VIP observation section, a figure in a pair of fatigues and an old sailor hat turned upside down came over and reintroduced himself as Colonel Charles Lindbergh. I had met him before, but only briefly. But that moment, the two of us stood there, and nobody bothered us. We were there for 15 or 20 minutes without interruption, and I was telling him at that time, as my hero, how much he had meant to me, and how much he encouraged me indirectly to become involved in aviation. And he said very, very graciously, Well, obviously, Captain, at that time, he said, you're doing the same thing for the people who are going to fly in space tomorrow to the planets and beyond. And it was a very poignant moment, one which I will never forget.
Well, Alan Shepard, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure, Terry.
Alan Shepard, recorded in 1994. A new special edition of The Right Stuff is just out on DVD. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today was Roberta Shorrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, and Anne-Marie Baldonado, with Patty Leswing, Jessica Chu, and Ian Chillog. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave. Hope you have a great 4th of July.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from Bantam Hardcover, a division of Random House, publisher of Once Removed, a novel about the enduring friendship between two stepsisters once removed, from the author of 101 Ways. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, photographer Christopher Morris. He's documented drug violence in Colombia, civil war in the former Yugoslavia, and the first war in the Persian Gulf. His latest photographs are part of a collection of Time magazine images of the recent war in Iraq. Join us for the next Fresh Air.